Hi, and welcome to a further installment of The Talking Show on Kaechung Radio, Los Angeles's only and very best Chinatown-based micro-broadcasting radio station. My name's Steve Cato, and joining me in the studio today, the one...
That's right.
The only...
Oh, yeah, don't stop there, Steve.
The irrepressible...
Uh-huh.
Nicholas G. Miller. Let's hear it for him, folks.
Oh, thanks for that introduction, Steve. You are too kind. Hello, everyone.
So, hey, Nick, how are things?
Things are good. It's too hot, as usual about this time of year.
Great.
It seems to sneak up on me every single year, you know?
Anyway... Yeah.
Yeah, I hear it's going to be a little cooler soon.
Oh.
Yeah, it's going to cool off. I know you'll like that, Steve.
Well.
How have you been, by the way?
I've been okay. Not too bad. Keeping cool. It was a pretty strange week we had last week with Jackson McClough. So, been recovering from that a little bit. And gearing up for today, actually. Because we have a very, very, very special guest today. Very busy man. Very important man. We have Carlos Fuentes, novelist, poet, diplomat, a man who's really done just about everything you can do. So we are very thrilled to have him here, are we not?
Oh, yeah.
And I think he's going to do some excellent talking.
Oh, yeah. We are stoked. Totally stoked.
That's right. So, let's have it. Carlos Fuentes.
Carlos Fuentes.
The year of the reed, Seacatl in the Aztec calendar, 1519 in the Christian chronology, rose ominously over the capital of the Aztec Empire, Tenochtitlan, present-day Mexico City. Comets streaked for long hours across the sky. The waters on which the city and Indian Venice was built churned up gigantic waves, toppling down houses and towers. The mirrors of the kingdom reflected starry skies at noon. Strange women roamed the streets at midnight, sobbing over the coming death of their children and the fall of the empire. Dreamers dreamt of apocalypse. The Aztec emperor, Moctezuma, then had all the dreamers brought to his court, there to repeat their dreams aloud. Once they had done so, they were all violently put to death. If the dreamers were killed, the dreams would not take place. By killing the dreamers, Moctezuma hoped to kill the future. But in one of the strangest coincidences in history, that future did arrive, precisely in the year foreseen for the return of the blonde, bearded god Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent, the god of creation, the good god who had given men maize, taught them the arts, and having fallen into temptation, fled to the east, but promised to return in peace if his children had peacefully cared for the earth, and in war if they had devastated the land and oppressed other human beings. For the ancient myth recalled that the earth had not been given to men by the gods. Men were not the owners of this earth, but its gardeners. The mythic world of pre-Columbian civilizations was not able to meet the challenge of the god Quetzalcoatl as he returned, blonde, bearded, on floating houses, riding snorting mythological beasts and spouting fire from his mouth. This was a sacred world, fearful of the chaos of the world being born and of the violence of the world coming to an end. It sustained the fragile universe through human sacrifice, feeding the sun with blood, otherwise it might never rise again. It honored it through an art of cosmic, barbaric figures that have survived their theological inception and today speak to us, in contemporary terms, of fear, of the yearning for unity, and of the transitoriness of human endeavor. This conception, this Indian conception of the world, also asserted itself through vertical authoritarian and militarist powers. It met the challenge of a nation that could no longer contain itself within its borders. Spain, riding on the militaristic dynamics of the prolonged war against the Moors, had united under the dual monarchy of the Catholic kings, Ferdinand and Isabella. It had conquered the last stronghold of Islam in Spain, the Kingdom of Granada. It had expelled the Jews from Spain. It had revived the Holy Inquisition, strengthening it under the power of the crown. And it had discovered, thanks to the genius of Christopher Columbus, a new world. The discoverers and conquerors, the conquistadores, of the Iberian New World were natural offshoots of the 7 centuries of crusading militarism against the Moors. They were also protagonists of the rise of the Spanish middle class, the homines novi, or new men, of a new urban civilization slowly evolving towards local democracy, local political assemblies, charters of local rights, and independent judicial authorities. They were men who had inherited nothing. Pizarro, the conqueror of Peru, was an illiterate swineherd. But Cortés, the conqueror of Mexico, was a dropout from law school at Salamanca University, the son of a mill owner in Extremadura, a man who had to make himself and his world. The conquest of the New World pitted autocratic, vertically structured Indian empires against bands of Machiavellian, non-hereditary princes. Princes without royal blood, princes with no pedigree except their energy, their will, and their personalities. They outwitted societies that could only hear the voices of the gods. The conquistadores heard the voices of men and women. In Mexico, the conquest was successful because Cortés heard the complaints of the tribes subjected to the Aztecs and organized them against the supreme Indian ruler, Moctezuma. Moctezuma only heard the voices of the gods, and these told him that Cortés was the god Quetzalcoatl, come back to reclaim his kingdom. Renaissance secular energy defeated a sacred mythical world. But the authoritarian vertical structures of Indian power were not substituted by horizontal democratic structures. They were finally replaced by another authoritarian vertical structure, that of the Spanish Empire, as under the King Charles V, it came to see itself as the inheritor to the medieval Holy Roman Empire. The seeds of local democracy in Spain were crushed by Charles V, when he defeated the revolution of the Castilian communities in 1521, asserting royal authority against both the weak remnants of weak Spanish feudalism and the strong currents of middle-class, urban, professional, and artisanal democracy surging in the cities of Castile. So we have this immediate irony in the very birth of Latin America. The conquistador, thinking he has triumphed in the new world, has just been defeated in the old world. Mexico City surrenders to Cortés in 1521. That same year, the chieftains of the Comunero rebellion are executed in Castile. When a year ago the municipal reforms in Mexico were introduced by the de la Madrid administration, giving municipalities for the first time a constitutional right to collect their own taxes and exercise their own police authority, I was shocked to realize that these basic democratic tenets came so late to us. Why? Why? I asked a prominent political friend in Mexico, and he answered me, because Charles V hanged the leaders of the Comunero Revolution by their necks in 1521. Was there any realistic chance for a grassroots democracy to take hold in Latin America in the early 16th century? A fact must first be understood. Spanish feudalism was probably the weakest in Europe for the simple reason that starting in 711 AD and ending in 1492, the War of the Reconquista against the Moors meant a constant shifting of frontiers and a constant impossibility to lay claim to the land as well as the abundance of many twilight zones and buffer regions between Christianity and Islam. The relationship between the crown and the explorers and conquerors is one of the great conflicts of the New World, and it defined the nature of political power in Latin America. But the conflict also has to do with the appropriation of land and labor. It continues to be relevant, if only for this powerful reason. Who owns the wealth of Latin America? How and to whom is it distributed? This battle is still being waged from Mexico and Cuba to Chile and Argentina. But in the 16th century, it was focused on whether the Spanish crown, which had just affirmed its centralist powers against both a weak feudality and a vigorous democracy, was about to permit a rebirth of either factor, feudalism or democracy, in the New World. The conquistadores soon simplified the political choices of the crown. They were products of modern-oriented individualism. They were arrivistes, Renaissance men on the make. They could have chosen, as the homines novi, the new men of England and France, did later in the 17th and 18th centuries, to stake their claims to personal ambition and social ascension on a constitutional order. Having conquered the Indians, they would have then conquered the crown. They would have been, as the settlers of New England were to become, the fathers of their own local democracy. The conquistadores did not, perhaps they could not, choose this avenue. Between individualism as democracy and individualism as feudal might, they chose the latter. They thus sacrificed their individualistic virtue, their Machiavellian virtù, to a spectral vision of the power that their ancestors had never had. But they must be understood. They had conquered the New World. They were the only power. They could usurp land and labor at will. Who was to stop them? This preemptive possession of the wealth of the Indies always admitted the dues to the crown, the so-called Royal Fifth, and the pro forma declaration that lands and labor were conquered in the name of the king. But as a matter of fact, the conquistadores got a head start on the crown. Both parties knew this. It was a matter of time before the conflict became acute. When it did, the conquistadores had facilitated the choice of the crown. They had not created civic, democratic communities, town halls, and municipal freedoms. They wanted to be what their fathers had never been in the old world. They wanted to be feudal lords, hidalgos, as proven by Cortés the Conqueror of Mexico, when the chronicler Bernal Díaz del Castillo describes him preparing his expedition, and as soon as he is appointed general, he begins, I quote Bernal, to adorn himself and to take much more care of his appearance than before. He wears a hat of feathers with a medallion and a gold chain and a velvet cloak trimmed with loops of gold. Yet this splendid hidalgo, says Bernal, has nothing with which to meet these expenses, for at that time he was very poor and in debt. The spendthrift generosity of the patrimonialist clans of Latin America and their seigneurial ambition are already depicted by Bernal Díaz in the figure of Cortés and the conquistadores. They wanted to be hidalgos. They wanted to be feudal lords. And this is what the crown set out to demolish. Certainly, the crown would have also opposed a democratic direction of the settlers' politics in the New World. Would that have posed a more difficult conundrum for Madrid? Since it did not happen, we can only speculate. The fact is that the conquerors wanted hidalguía, the status of gentlemen. But hidalguía does not mean hard work. Quite the contrary. It means not having to labor with your hands, but winning glory in the field of battle, and then receiving the reward for your effort in lives and lands that should work for you. The same thing happened after the Wars of Independence against Spain in the 1820s. Simón Bolívar and the other libertadores, much as the conquistadores 3 centuries before them, had to reward their armies, from generals to privates, with land. The privates could not uphold their claims. The officers could and did. But if the armies of independence ended by overrunning the power of the state and abusing it to this very day from Guatemala to Chile, the armies of the conquest were halted in their political and economic momentum by the crown of Spain. The malice and deftness with which the Spanish crown dealt with the conquistadores of the New World is a case history of political expertise and one-upmanship. These men had to be rewarded, but not too much. And their titles to land and labor had to remain uncertain, precarious, revertible to the crown after a generation or two. The crown unleashed on the conquistadores the propagandistic fury of Friar Bartolomé de las Casas, ostensibly to protect the Indians from servitude, but actually to protect the crown from feudalism. The culmination of Father de las Casas' long campaign against colonial servitude was the Laws of Indies of 1542, which proclaimed the Indians to be proprietors of the lands of the New World, while the settlers held only temporary concessions over them. The violations of this statute are so numerous and evident that any modern auditor can not only spot them, but quickly arrive at the conclusion that Latin America was founded on a dizzying contradiction between law and practice, in effect establishing from the very beginning a divorce between the real country and the legal country. The distinction belongs to the French right-wing ideologue Charles Maurras. It perfectly expresses the constantly contradictory and extremely dualistic nature of Latin American societies. Along with Father Las Casas, a dark cloud of Spanish bureaucrats dressed in black and armed with quill pens descended on the hapless conquistadores and soon reduced them to pitiful powerlessness. They wanted to be feudal lords, hidalgos, as proven by Cortés the Conqueror of Mexico when the chronicler Bernal Díaz del Castillo describes him preparing his expedition, and as soon as he is appointed general, he begins, I quote Bernal, to adorn himself and to take much more care of his appearance than before. He wears a hat of feathers with a medallion and a gold chain and a velvet cloak trimmed with loops of gold. Yet this splendid hidalgo, says Bernal, has nothing with which to meet these expenses, for at that time he was very poor and in debt. The spendthrift generosity of the patrimonialist clans of Latin America and their seigneurial ambition are already depicted by Bernal Díaz in the figure of Cortés and the conquistadores. They wanted to be hidalgos. They wanted to be feudal lords. And this is what the crown set out to demolish. Certainly, the crown would have also opposed a democratic direction of the settlers' politics in the New World. Would that have posed a more difficult conundrum for Madrid? Since it did not happen, we can only speculate. The fact is that the conquerors wanted hidalguía, the status of gentlemen. But hidalguía does not mean hard work, quite the contrary. It means not having to labor with your hands, but winning glory in the field of battle, and then receiving the reward for your effort in lives and lands that should work for you. The same thing happened after the Wars of Independence against Spain in the 1820s. Simón Bolívar and the other libertadores, much as the conquistadores 3 centuries before them, had to reward their armies, from generals to privates, with land. The privates could not uphold their claims. The officers could and did. But if the armies of independence ended by overrunning the power of the state and abusing it to this very day from Guatemala to Chile, the armies of the conquest were halted in their political and economic momentum by the crown of Spain. The malice and deftness with which the Spanish crown dealt with the conquistadores of the New World is a case history of political expertise and one-upmanship. These men had to be rewarded, but not too much. And their titles to land and labor had to remain uncertain, precarious, revertible to the crown after a generation or two. The crown unleashed on the conquistadores the propagandistic fury of Friar Bartolomé de las Casas, ostensibly to protect the Indians from servitude, but actually to protect the crown from feudalism. The culmination of Father de las Casas' long campaign against colonial servitude was the Laws of Indies of 1542, which proclaimed the Indians to be proprietors of the lands of the New World, while the settlers held only temporary concessions over them. Violations of this statute are so numerous and evident that any modern auditor can not only spot them, but quickly arrive at the conclusion that Latin America was founded on a dizzying contradiction between law and practice, in effect establishing from the very beginning a divorce between the real country and the legal country. The distinction belongs to the French right-wing ideologue Charles Maurras. It perfectly expresses the constantly contradictory and extremely dualistic nature of Latin American societies. Along with Father Las Casas, a dark cloud of Spanish bureaucrats dressed in black and armed with quill pens descended on the hapless conquistadores and soon reduced them to pitiful powerlessness. Who could compete against this bevy of lawyers, counselors, inspectors, sophists, and zealous representatives of political centralization? Columbus is shipped back to Spain in irons. Gonzalo Pizarro is publicly beheaded in Peru. Hernán Cortés ends his life writing letters to King Charles. Pathetic letters in which the conqueror sees himself old and poor, his properties pawned, his servants suing him for salaries due, and his tailors presenting old debts. At 63, Cortés writes to the emperor, after having conquered for him a nation 9 times the size of Spain, he would not want to prowl around the Spanish inns anymore, but, I quote Cortés, to receive the fruit of my labors and return to Mexico as soon as justice is done to me. So ended these extraordinary men of the Renaissance. But if the discovery and conquest of the New World was a feat of the Renaissance imagination, it was so because the Old World needed a utopia and found it in the New World. America was not discovered, says the Mexican historian Edmundo O'Gorman. It was invented. It was needed. The excessive flow of Renaissance energies, the dramatic contradiction between its dreams of human greatness and its realities of human cruelty expressed in war, greed, and apostasy, claimed for Europe a space of utopia, a world where it could cleanse itself of its vices. St. Thomas More's utopia came to the New World and was implemented in many Indian communities from Mexico to Paraguay by civilized friars who saw in utopia the model needed to save the Indians from desperation. The old aboriginal worlds had come crashing down. However shaky the possessions of the conquistadores in the New World, they exploited Indian labor to a degree that amounted to genocide. The native population of the Caribbean was decimated and had to be replaced by black slave labor imported from Africa. Between 1492 and 1640, the population of Mexico and the Antilles fell from 25 million to 1 million, and that of Andean South America from 3.5 million to 500,000. Slave labor in the plantation was only slightly better than slave labor in the mines. The laws of Indies were not applied, and the sharp divisions between the real country and the legal country were sharpened even more by the cynicism of the Latin American remark, "La ley se obedece, pero no se cumple." The law is obeyed, but then it is disregarded. Spanish America saw the utopian dream of its conception whipped to death on the haciendas of Mexico and the encomiendas of Cuba. Utopia disappeared down the mine shafts of Guanajuato and Potosí. But the crown and the church, politically triumphant over the conquistadores, were not able to contain local injustices. The crown was too far away, the church too compromised in the double mission of evangelizing heathens and accumulating its own wealth. The triumph of the Reformation in Europe strengthened Spain's mission as the defender of the faith and the upholder of the repressive tenets of the Counter-Reformation. The culture of Latin America arises as a response to this set of circumstances. It was from the very beginning, as the Cuban writer José Lezama Lima called it, the culture of the counter-conquest, a syncretic culture where the naked sacrality of the Indian world could hide itself and reincarnate fully dressed with the robes of Christianity, where African sorcerers could reappear as Catholic priests, where idols could hide behind altars, and the huge vacuum between the dream of utopia and the reality of colonialism could be filled in poetry, in architecture, in religion, in food, in manners, in taste, by the expansive hunger of the Latin American Baroque. The Baroque of the magnificent poetry of the 17th century Mexican nun, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, silenced at age 40 by the church. The Baroque of the magnificent statues of the 18th century Brazilian sculptor Alejandrino, creatures of a Baroque circular world demanding to be seen totally in time as well as space. The simplest Baroque of churches decorated, following Christian gravures of the saints, but actually transforming this new religious space into Indian paradises, overflowing with the fruits of the tropics and with the smiling faces of brown Indian angels. The dramatic Baroque of the bloody Christs lying dead in their glass cages, crowned with spines, wrapped in red velvet and gold braid. A God sacrificed for men, the triumph of Christianity in an Indian culture accustomed to men being sacrificed to the gods. The colonial period ruined the utopian promise of the New World. The cities of the sun perished in the flames of robust Christian faith. The Golden Age was melted down and sent as bullion to Spain, through whose hot and mendicant hands it slipped and went on to finance capitalist development in London, Antwerp, Hamburg, and the other northern cities where the Jewish bourgeoisie expelled from Spain in 1492 had migrated to. Deprived of her Jewish and Arab bankers, administrators, ministers, ambassadors, tax collectors, and moneylenders, Spain generated an incompetent, centralist legal bureaucracy, formal heir to the Roman tradition of the written law and imperial legitimation. Its incompetence was ably disguised by its infinite capacity for intrigue. The failure of the so-called Invincible Armada sent by Philip II against Elizabeth I demonstrated Spain's incapacity to play the dominant role in world or even European affairs. Yet, at the same time that its decadence began, Spain spawned one of the most brilliant constellations of writers and artists that the world has known. Cervantes, Quevedo, Góngora, Velázquez, Calderón de la Barca, Saint Teresa, Saint John of the Cross, Murillo, El Greco. The children of Iberia in the New World would also share with her this ability to compensate the failure of history with the triumphs of art. But Spanish America was deprived of everything that modern Europe came to represent: religious nonconformity and civil disobedience, free inquiry, doubt and criticism, the foundations of modern science and modern politics. Spanish America was saddled with all the things that European modernity judged intolerable: privilege as the norm, charity as the exception, the militant church, dogma, and inquisition. The distance between the law and its practice, between the government and the governed. The distance between utopian ideals and colonial realities. The distance between the Golden Age and the Age of Iron, between the noble savage and the chained peon. The distance between the law and its practice, between the crown and its colonies, and between the social layers and institutions of the colonies themselves. The distance between the isolated localities and the central metropolis, between the old and the new gods, between the real country and the legal country, between the spiritual mission and the temporal wealth of the church, between the two nations, haves and have-nots, between expectations and rewards. This distance set the stage by the end of the 18th century for national independence in the former colonies of Spain and Portugal in the New World. It also charged us with changing these realities by ourselves, since they are a part of our centuries-old experience. Their persistence is a challenge to us today. Our family quarrels have their origins in them. We are, because of our tradition, at war with ourselves. And only we can truly understand and solve these problems. On Palm Sunday, 1766, angry mobs attacked the residence of the Marquis de Squillace, a minister in the court of the Bourbon King of Spain, Charles III. The Marquis, who was Italian by birth, was judged guilty of a decree forbidding big floppy hats and flowing dark capes in Madrid because they helped criminals to strike and escape unknown. Instead, madrileños were encouraged to wear the undisguisable three-cornered hat. This assault on Madrid's proverbial sense of drama, which perhaps hit lovers harder than criminals, was part of King Charles's modernization campaign, which pretended to propel Spain out of the long Habsburg lethargy that began with the defeat of the invincible Armada and ended with the childless reign of Charles II, the bewitched, the impotent, retarded monarch who cured his splitting headaches by having live pigeons killed on top of his head and feeling the warm blood dripping down his face. The treasures of the New World slipped through the fingers of the Habsburg monarchy and went abroad to pay for costly wars, imported manufactures, and grandiose conceits, such as Philip II's imperial monastery and necropolis at El Escorial, the place the poet García Lorca would one day write, "Where all the cold rains in the world come from." The distant American colonies of Spain were colonies of a colony. For if we became the colony of Spain, Spain became a colony of northern capitalist Europe. We were the Indies of Spain, Spain was the Indies of Europe. Louis XIV of France put it most succinctly: "Let us now sell merchandise to the Spanish and obtain from them gold and silver." Habsburg disorganization distanced the colonies from Madrid. The very laxness of imperial authority during the long decline of the 17th century furthered the movement towards some kind of self-reliance in the American colonies. These were rapidly becoming Creole nations, that is, nations dominated by the white descendants of Spaniards in the New World. But the Creoles, the Criollos, were certainly not the majority in Spanish America. By 1810, when the revolutions of independence with astonishing simultaneity caught fire from the viceroyalty of New Spain, Mexico, in the north, to the viceroyalty of the River Plate, Buenos Aires, in the south, Creoles constituted roughly 19% of the 23 million inhabitants of Iberian America. Indians were 36%, and blacks, mulattos, and mestizos, 45%. But the Creoles more and more came to control land and labor, and left to themselves and their wiles, they even started minimal programs in manufacturing and commercial expansion, based on the abundance of raw material and cheap labor. Now, the reforms introduced by Charles III in Spain meant modernization of Spain, but they also meant further colonization of the colonies to pay for Spanish modernization. The colonies were told that they would be more than ever dependent on the metropolis, denied the right to manufacture, and forced to import manufactured goods from Spain, denied the right to trade between themselves, and imposed of the obligation to trade only with the metropolis. The monarchy's response to the Squillace riots had been to blame them on the Jesuits and expel the Company of Jesus from Spain and her colonies in 1767. The Jesuits had been introducing the study of science, mathematics, geography, and history into the colonies, dominated up till then by scholastic thinking and inquisitorial supervision. Books were smuggled in: Voltaire, Rousseau, Montesquieu. News arrived: revolution in France, revolution in the 13 American colonies of Britain. Questions were raised: could one substitute a monarchy for a republic? Could one oust a colonial power? Why were the French and Spanish monarchy supporting the claims of the rebels in Virginia, the anti-monarchists in Massachusetts, the Republicans in Pennsylvania? Could we also become modern nations? Could we also become independent nations? These questions radicalized the intellectuals of the colonies. They radicalized the lower clergy, whose privileges were taken away from them by the modernizing zeal of the Bourbons. They radicalized the local militias, who had for the first time a taste of victory in Buenos Aires in 1806, when they defeated a British invasion that the viceroy had been incapable of repelling. They radicalized the Creole merchants who spoke through the voice of Mariano Moreno in Argentina, demanding freedom to import what they did not have and freedom to export what was left over to pay for it. They radicalized the mestizos, the Latin Americans of mixed European and Indian descent, who in 1781 marched on Bogotá, demanding more opportunities for Americans and better treatment for Indians. They radicalized the expelled Jesuits, who identified with the cause of Americanism and wrote national histories of Mexico and Chile from Rome, where they intrigued against the Spanish monarchy. All of these factors came to a boil in 1808, when for the first time since the invasion of the Moors, Spain was occupied by a foreign power, Napoleonic France, which deposed the Bourbon monarch Ferdinand VII. The colonies immediately declared that in the absence of a Spanish king, they were free to govern themselves until the monarchy was restored in Madrid. When that happened, it was too late. The momentum of the independence had extended from Mexico City to Buenos Aires. And as the Creoles, with their mestizo, black, and Indian armies, fought the Spanish royalists during the next 15 years, all the past contradictions, and quite a set of new ones, made their appearance in Latin America. While retaining the traumatic events of conquest and colonization, a lost utopia, a reverberating Aboriginal myth, and a desperate Baroque and syncretic culture, Latin America now heaped conflict upon conflict. Independence revealed the existence within each polity of two nations. It not only revealed it, but furthered it. Most attempts to bridge the gulf between haves and have-nots were merely legalistic and in themselves furthered a second conflict, the colonial conflict between the legal country and the real country. The Indians everywhere were given full civil liberties and equality by the insurgents, but they remained the victims of serfdom and economic backwardness. The Spanish past was brutally denied. In its place, we set the shining example of Britain, France, and the United States. By emulating them, by copying their laws, we would instantly become, like them, modern, progressive, prosperous, democratic. This was not to be. And the tremendous gulf between law and reality, between desire and its object, was filled by the caudillo, the Machiavellian strongman, the dictatorial figure capable of maintaining a semblance of unity in the pulverized societies that followed independence. From Juan Manuel de Rosas in Argentina to Porfirio Díaz in Mexico, passing through the sinister Dr. Francia, who shut Paraguay off from the world, or the tragic comic Santa Ana, who lost half of Mexico to the United States, or the wily Juan Vicente Gómez, who opened Venezuela up to the petroleum companies. These figures perpetuated the colonial situation of the majority, while at best creating prosperity for the minority. Olds, with their mestizo, black, and Indian armies fought the Spanish royalists. During the next 15 years, all the past contradictions and quite a set of new ones made their appearance in Latin America. While retaining the traumatic events of conquest and colonization, a lost utopia, a reverberating Aboriginal myth, and a desperate Baroque and syncretic culture, Latin America now heaped conflict upon conflict. Independence revealed the existence within each polity of two nations. It not only revealed it, but furthered it. Most attempts to bridge the gulf between haves and have-nots were merely legalistic and in themselves furthered a second conflict, the colonial conflict between the legal country and the real country. The Indians everywhere were given full civil liberties and equality by the insurgents, but they remained the victims of serfdom and economic backwardness. The Spanish past was brutally denied. In its place, we set the shining example of Britain, France, and the United States. By emulating them, by copying their laws, we would instantly become, like them, modern, progressive, prosperous, democratic. This was not to be. And the tremendous gulf between law and reality, between desire and its object, was filled by the caudillo, the Machiavellian strongman, the dictatorial figure capable of maintaining a semblance of unity in the pulverized societies that followed independence. From Juan Manuel de Rosas in Argentina to Porfirio Díaz in Mexico, passing through the sinister Dr. Francia, who shut Paraguay off from the world, or the tragic comic Santa Ana, who lost half of Mexico to the United States, or the wily Juan Vicente Gómez, who opened Venezuela up to the petroleum companies. These figures perpetuated the colonial situation of the majority while, at best, creating prosperity for the minority. Simón Bolívar, the liberator, had attempted to bridge these realities between real and legal country, between prosperous minorities and dispossessed majorities, between central and local authority, through what in effect was the model for compromise between two forms of Latin American conservatism, national and regional. At best, this furthered an inauthentic progress in which Latin America profited from the worldwide expansion of capitalism, by providing it with raw materials, but without providing ourselves with capital for investment and savings. In the 19th century, we became orphans of our own peripheral capitalism, feverishly substituting imports to uphold patterns of consumption in the middle to upper classes, while again postponing any rational approach to the welfare of the majority. Since independence, we had been practicing our version of cactus Reaganomics. Let the rich grow richer, and eventually the poor will become less poor. From his deathbed in Santa Marta in 1830, Simón Bolívar wrote in disillusionment and despair, "America is ungovernable. Those who serve the revolution plow the seas." Now, this is quite moving and perhaps even melodramatic. But in reality, there were things to be done then as there are things to be done today in Latin America. We can try to understand all the negative factors of our history, the weight of Indian autocracy and Spanish imperialism, colonial structures, legal leisure demand, and economic injustice. But there is no determinism in all of this. We made our own history, and we can change it. Real country against legal country, central against local authority, two nations, the army as arbiter of power, economies oriented towards serving the few by increasing foreign dependency. All this is true, if not good, but nothing says it is eternal. The revolutions of independence left a profound residue of nationalism in our countries. It can be argued that this only further divided us. It can also be argued that thanks to it, we have been able to sustain a minimal identity, which has furthered the continuity of our culture and helped us to defend ourselves from foreign pressures. The continuity of our culture. From the epic poet of the conquest of Chile, Alonso de Ercilla, to the modern poet of the reconquest of Spanish America, Pablo Neruda. From the Baroque statuary of the colonial sculptor of Brazil, Alejandrino, to the cosmic figures of the modern Mexican painter, Rufino Tamayo. From the mythic oral traditions of the jungle and the mountain to the modern narrative myths of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Latin American culture has maintained an uninterrupted vitality. This continuity is in brutal contrast with the hesitations and failures of our political history. Yet through the unity of civilization and the Balkanization of politics, we are challenged to create a model of progress of our own, not an extralogical imitation of Western forms, but a critical model of our own pertaining to our own culture, European, Indian, Black, Mestizo, born of our needs and experiences. This model has attempted to express itself through nationalism and through revolution, extreme forms of historical assertion and historical violence, that in order to change our societies without sacrificing their deeper unity, must meet the demands of cultural creation. Independent Latin America was to suffer grievously from foreign intervention and even dismemberment, as well as from foreign economic imperialism. Both our strengths and weaknesses as a culture and as independent nations soon came into conflict with another revolutionary force of the times, the United States of America. The admiration towards the American Revolution had been enormous in Latin America, as great as the admiration towards the French Revolution, even more so perhaps, since Washington and his men were, like us, Americans, former colonials, who proved capable of inaugurating a strong, vital democracy, of creating a new nation. This admiration was expressed through the widespread reproduction of the tenets of the Constitution of the United States in the new Latin American republics. But this yet another example of what the French sociologist Gabriel Tarde called extralogical imitation only reinforced the Latin American duality of a legal country disguising a real country. Furthermore, attitudes towards the United States soon aligned themselves on partisan lines, and these had a lot to do with the acceptance or refusal of the past. The two main political parties in 19th century Latin America were conservatives and liberals. The conservatives did not want a revolutionary, progressive future, but a reactionary past in which the aristocracy and the church retained their privileges. They also feared and hated the United States because the new republic signified modern values. Indeed, modernity at any price and the sacrifice of tradition, because it meant Protestantism versus Catholicism, because it meant revolutionary populism versus monarchical authority, because it meant progressive capitalism versus semi-feudal stagnation, because it meant their strength against our weakness and strength as expansionism. The liberals, on the contrary, were the pro-Americans who hailed in the United States all that the conservatives decried. Yet liberal admiration for the United States was soon to meet conservative suspicion as the former 13 colonies asserted themselves and their imperial ambitions in this hemisphere became, indeed, manifest destiny. Since 1801, President Thomas Jefferson was writing to James Monroe, I quote, Thomas Jefferson, "However our present interests may restrain us within our own limits, it is impossible not to look forward to distant times when our rapid multiplication will expand itself beyond those limits and cover the whole northern, if not the southern, continent with a people speaking the same language, governed in a similar form and by similar laws." End of quote. These sweeping exclusions of the cultural differences that might conceivably exist between a homogeneous metropolitan United States and a heterogeneous, eccentric Latin America were not accepted by Henry Clay when he responded to similar assertions of manifest destiny from John Quincy Adams in 1821. I quote Henry Clay, "Will gentlemen contend, because those people are not like us in all particulars, they are therefore unfit for freedom?" But Adams answers Clay and persists. "It is unavoidable that the remainder of the continent should be ours." Latin America did not have to wait for Jefferson's distant times before it was partially taken over. President Polk's war against Mexico in 1847 and the dismemberment of the independent republic, then the takeover of Nicaragua in 1857 by the American freebooter William Walker, and finally the declaration by President Cleveland's Secretary of State, Richard Olney, in 1895 that, I quote the Secretary, "Today the United States is practically sovereign on this continent, and its fiat is law upon the subjects to which it confines its interposition," end of quote, convinced even liberal admirers of United States democracy that the democracy was also an empire, and that this was its strength, but perhaps also its weakness. The shadow of the United States was a primordial factor for the assertion of a Latin American political, diplomatic, and cultural identity since the 19th century. Whenever Latin America has moved to deal radically with its conflictive heritage, it has clashed with the incapacity of the United States to come to terms with four intimately interrelated issues. These issues are nationalism and change, redistribution of power, and negotiations. This is the challenge, and Anthony Lewis has best stated it recently in the New York Times. I quote Mr. Lewis, "There is going to be social change in the Third World. The United States should learn to live with such change, even promote it, instead of treating every challenge to the status quo as Soviet-inspired, requiring East-West confrontation." End of quote. This is now truer than ever in the present-day conflict surrounding events in Central America and the Caribbean. We shall deal with this situation in the next two lectures. But before we do so, it is important to understand that Latin America, its difficult past, its problems unsolved, its problems yet to come, can only be taken care of by Latin Americans. Our debate is a debate within, a debate with ourselves, a family quarrel. The interference of extraneous factors only postpone our solutions and corrupt our legitimate aspirations. As our terrible century comes to an end, we clearly perceive that everywhere ideologies die and cultures reappear as the true harbingers of a more complete and conscious way of life. Perhaps Latin America will come to know its real identity in this flowering, as the millennium ends, of the hidden phases of civilizations. Latin America is part of a worldwide movement towards pluralism in international relations and a push away from bipolar relations. The arrogant nostalgia of both world powers over their so-called spheres of influence is the cause of a vacuum first and an escalation later, endangering both change and national independence in Latin America. Sometimes we think that the real menace to each of the great powers is not the other power, but the independence of the national states, Poland or Nicaragua, El Salvador or Afghanistan, Honduras or Czechoslovakia. We must overcome this sterile dualism in order to know our place in the new concert of cultures, which seems to prefigure the physiognomy of the coming century. In such a concert, perhaps Latin America shall discover that it has something to do, something to say, something to recover, and something to give.
Carlos Fuentes, with the third of the 1984 Massey Lectures on Latin America at War with the Past. He'll be back with his fourth lecture tomorrow night to talk about Latin America, the United States, and revolution.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That was great, wasn't it?
Oh, that was very enlightening.
You know, Nicholas, you're from Texas. You got any wisdom to bring to the table or experiences relating to Mr. Fuentes's lecture?
Well, you know, I have spent some time down on the Texas-Mexico border, and I will say that it is a troubling place.
Wow.
Yeah. You go down there, and you stand up, say, on a hillside, and look out at Mexico, and everything you can sense seems very similar to the place you are. The landscape looks the same. The buildings look the same. The temperature, even the weather. It just all seems very similar. And to think that this river, the Rio Grande, which, for the most part, the places I've been, is not a river, it's a dry bed, what they call an arroyo, is what separates you from that other place, is very abstract and confusing. And I think to understand the situation we find ourselves in, the situation where I'm afraid to go over there, I have active fear when I think of going to that place, I think we have to look to the past. And Mr. Fuentes helps us here. Because there is a just past that lingers with us, and that's presented us with this situation that's very abstract and difficult to understand. So difficult that it would cause our government here in the U.S. to act fastly and furiously, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I have to say I was also very, very, very impressed.
Oh yeah, I would agree. It made a deep impression. Deep.
Well, I'm sure we'll have some treats for you in the coming week. So, all of you, our listeners in Los Angeles and around the world via the internet, please tune in next week for another installment of The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio.
Thanks, and have a nice night.